We'll call our first case United States versus Gussie. Ms. Dowling.
Good morning, judges.
You may proceed.
Thank you. My name is Renee Dowling. I'm a counsel for Jacinta A. Gussie. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
That's done. Thanks.
Thank you. Go ahead. Your Honor, in this matter, we're here because an indictment was handed down on September 15th, 2016, as against the appellant Jacinta Gussie and 9 other co-defendants. Your Honor, after the indictment was handed down, between the months of January 2017 and July 2017, the government knew that sitting on the grand jury of September 15th, 2016, was a named victim, a victim who was named in the indictment, the very indictment that she voted to a true bill for. The government learned of this fact between, according to the government, January 2017 and July 2017. And during that time—
Well, we're well familiar with the facts, Ms. Dowling. We've taken a look at those. Let's get right into some questions with you, if that's okay. As I understand it, you're making a statute of limitations argument as well as your specific constitutional arguments.
Yes, sir.
Do you agree or disagree that if the superseding indictment in this case, because there was a later indictment by a grand jury that didn't have the victim on it, if that superseding indictment is not time barred, then there's not a basis for complaint associated with the initial problematic grand jury? Is that a fair statement? I'm setting aside your prosecutorial misconduct argument.
I understand. If, Your Honor, I would say that that is a fair statement if it is not time barred. However, the defendant clearly argues that it is in fact time barred.
I understand that that's your position. So work with me then with respect to your reasoning for why you believe it's time barred. It goes back to the idea that there's a defect in the first indictment that made that indictment void ab initio. Right from the start, there was no indictment there, correct?
Right.
So if we thought that there was a problem with it, but it wasn't void, then there would be a relation back, right?
Correct.
Okay. So work with us to explain why, from your perspective, the defect in that indictment is analogous to things we've said in the past, render an indictment basically void. I think in cases where there's racial or gender discrimination in the grand jury makeup, we may have said that, but I'm not aware of it happening in any other circumstance. How is it that this problem is akin to those circumstances where in the past we've said it's as if there were no indictment at all?
Your Honor, the problem here, I believe, stems from the fact that the Fifth Amendment guarantees a right to a grand jury, to an indictment by a grand jury. The grand jury, Your Honor, is presumed in the Fifth Amendment that the grand jury that you're going to have the right to appear before or have your crimes chart come up before should be an unbiased grand jury. Your Honor, of course, this is a case of first impression, and I can understand that the court has some issue with grappling with the matter, but it's akin to that, because if we are to let a victim who is the victim named in the grand jury, not just a potential victim out there, but a victim whose name appeared in the grand jury indictment, and allow that victim to then determine whether or not—
Counsel, but we didn't. I mean, the government didn't. I understand that that would certainly be a problem, but didn't, I thought we had already agreed that if the government cured that defect, then there was no violation of the grand jury, right? Or did you have a different argument on that point?
I didn't agree that if the government cured, because the government hasn't cured. The government, the statute in this instance, the crimes and the last overt act in the series of crimes in the 119 count indictment occurred on or about, was alleged to have occurred on or about May 30th, 2012. The first indictment was handed down September 15th, 2016. The superseding indictment did not occur until October 5th of 2018, way beyond the statute of limitations.
Right. So your point isn't the substantive grand jury, right? It's that the indictment wasn't validly pending when it was impaneled with a witness. So what is the authority for why that defect, and defect it clearly was, rendered the indictment not validly pending as a procedural matter? Because my understanding is that that's what we've said is the touchstone, that the indictment was pending because it had been filed. And the fact that it was defective as a matter of the Fifth Amendment doesn't undo that procedural filing. And so then you're left to argue the substantive point, but as we said, the substantive point appears to be cured with the superseding indictment. So why was the indictment not validly pending during that time?
Well, Your Honor, it's a situation in which the grand jury proceedings, as you know, don't include neither the judges nor defense lawyers. So the only person who had knowledge of this defect with regards to the grand jury is the government. The government
understands that. I'm sorry to interrupt, Ms. Dowling, but we got some limited time here. So I don't think we're getting to the question that's being put to you, which is your fundamental point on both the substantive constitutional issues and the statute of limitations, if I understand it, comes down to this was no grand jury at all because it had the victim on it. And therefore, anything it did could not constitute an indictment. Am I right about that? That's the fundamental point?
Yes, Your Honor, but in addition, what we're the problem fundamentally that this court should have with what took place in Jacinta Gussie's matter is that the government is the only one with the knowledge. The government sat on that knowledge. Had the defense known about the defect? Yeah.
That's your prosecutorial misconduct argument. And I'm trying to set that aside for a minute and just focus on your assertion that there was no validly pending indictment because this was no grand jury at all because it was tainted with the victim being on it. I think you've agreed that that's your argument, right?
Right.
Okay. Then you got to explain to us how we get around Alexander, which actually deals with this very grand jury. It's not an analogous grand jury. It's our own case from last year, 2021. It deals with one of Ms. Gussie's co-defendants. It was this very grand jury, and in a precedential opinion, a panel of this court said the grand jury defect Alexander challenges, and we could just take the word Alexander out and put Gussie in, goes to the legal propriety of the original indictment and is not so fundamental that it caused the grand jury no longer to be a grand jury or the indictment no longer to be an indictment. That's a binding statement of a panel who looked at this very grand jury and the very problem you're talking about and said, it is a defect. It's not that what the government did was good. It's a problem, but it was not a problem of the character as to vitiate the grand jury status as a grand jury or to make the indictment void ab initio. So how could we get around that language from Alexander, which seems to go straight to the heart of your argument?
Your Honor, I understand that Alexander was decided on the basis of the fact that it was an interlocutory, basically a civil procedure, an interlocutory appeal versus the matter that the issue had not been ripe for determination.
Yeah, there was a jurisdictional element, but this statement of Alexander is going straight to this issue, isn't it? This the statement I quoted.
Yes, it's going straight to the issue that you're, the statement that you quoted, John.
Okay. Well, is there anything else that you want to say? Because we're at your mark, your 10-minute mark. You've got 5 minutes reserved for rebuttal, but I'll let you wrap up unless Judge Roth or Judge Mady, anything from either of you before we give Ms. Dowling a chance to make any close on this?
I have nothing further.
Nothing further.
Okay, Ms. Dowling, anything you want to say before we hand the ball off to Mr. Sleeper?
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, the appellant's right is so fundamental, Your Honor, that the egregious actions should in fact vitiate the impaneling of the initial grand jury. The initial grand jury, Your Honor, was not a grand jury at all. We're not with a victim sitting on the grand jury.
Okay, we have your position. Thanks very much. We'll have you back on rebuttal. Mr. Sleeper, your argument.
Good morning, Your Honor. Adam Sleeper for the United States. May it please the court. I'm going to direct my comments initially to the statute of limitations issue, since that appears to be the court's focus.
Can you first fill out the record a bit? What took the government so long between discovering the error and notifying the defendant?
Regretfully, Your Honor, I am limited to the record on this. The AUSA at the time is no longer with the office. I am not the AUSA who handled this below. I know that's not the answer that judges like to hear, but
not particularly, because this argument's been pending for some time. I would have assumed that would have been a question your office would be prepared to answer. But if you're not, then fine. Continue with your argument.
Yes, Your Honor, I'm limited to the statements in that affidavit.
Why don't you go ahead and make them now? Anyway, what possible reason is there for sitting on this information for months and months and months, leaving aside the stupendous oversight? I mean, it's hard to find a polite way to frame it, of seating somebody on the grand jury who's named as a victim in interviews with investigating agents.
Yes, Your Honor. Is this a question directed to the record, or would you like me to answer that with something outside the record at this point?
You answer it any way you like. We just are wondering how we can deal with this. I mean, we got a situation where, leaving aside the indictment issue, your opponent has said there's prosecutorial misconduct here and there should be a consequence for it. So we're looking for an answer to that.
Your Honor, and to be clear, this is outside the record. In my experience before the grand jury, I don't have a list of the names of the grand jurors that are before the grand jury that I compare against. That's not something I generally have. I can speculate that the AUSA in this matter may also have not had a list to compare against, but that, again, that's pure speculation and based on my own experience before the grand jury. Now, as to what occurred in those intervening months, I think there's a few things that the court can look to in the affidavit. One, it doesn't appear that the AUSA thought this was a constitutional issue that needed to be corrected upon immediate review. Now, certainly I think this court and the district court have taken a different position certainly held in the case of the district court. But I think part of that was the issue. I think the other issue is that there were weighing.
Well, let's interrupt you just long enough to ask this. We may well agree, and indeed an earlier panel did agree with you, that it didn't look like there was a constitutional violation here. But the fact that it's not a constitutional violation, does that mean that it was an exercise of sound judgment, or maybe an exercise of judgment so bad as to constitute misconduct, to not bring to the attention of the court and the defense that there was a defect in the indictment? Actually, I ought to just stop and ask this preliminary question. You're not taking the position, are you, that there's no defect in that original indictment, are you?
No, Your Honor. At this point, we are not taking that position. Okay. But yes. But we're talking about the good and bad faith of the prosecutor below. Now, at the time, the prosecutor appears to have not believed there was a defect. Was also weighing considerations regarding grand jury disclosure rules, among other things, and. There actually hasn't even been a determination by any court, though this certainly isn't an issue that the court needs to resolve here, that this information did need to be turned over. The district court ultimately didn't resolve that issue.
Are you, that's a little bit of a surprise. Are you asking us to go into that?
Because
if you are,
not.
We can.
No, Your Honor, I am not asking. I'm simply going to what was going through the prosecutor's mind at the time and whether or not this is, and again, Your Honor, we're not taking the position that everything the prosecutor did in this case was the way it should have been done, the way it ideally should have been done. What we are saying is, at most, this rises to negligence rather than recklessness.
Well, here's just a suggestion for you. I think it would be in the interest of the Department of Justice and the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of the Virgin Islands to just simply own up to this and say, we should have done this sooner. We should have done it. Instead of saying, you know, at most, this is negligent. It's just not helpful. It's not helpful to own your own mistakes. Own it, and then people can move past it. But when the government sort of plays this game of, you know, at worst, it's negligence. When you're sitting on information, which everybody acknowledges makes the grand jury's actions defective. I don't get it. Now, maybe we're burning time on something we shouldn't, but there's a prosecutorial misconduct argument in this case. And I take it the government is just trying to say, nothing to see here, but it looks like there's something to see here and the government ought to deal with it.
Your Honor, a few things on that. First of all, we were not saying nothing to say here. I think that we are certainly willing to agree that this was not handled in the way it should have been handled. I think even the AUSA below admitted that at the hearing before the district judge, I believe he said that this should have been handled more expeditiously. This is not a case where the government has said everything was fine as to how this was handled, and this is, you know, a textbook way to do it. So I certainly note the court's concerns, but I would also say has not been the government's position that this was handled in the ideal way, or this is how we would handle it in the future. And certainly there won't be a future with this issue. So I just want to make that clear to
the
court.
All right. Well, unless my colleagues want to pursue the misconduct thing further, why don't you go ahead to the substance of the argument and the assertion that your colleague on the other side has made, that the defect here is absolutely fundamental and such that it can't be overlooked. It can't be treated as some kind of a minor defect that doesn't go to the existence of the indictment in the first instance.
Yes, Your Honor. A few points on that. First, we don't believe that the voidable question is actually the right question for the relation back issue. In the government's view, the relation back turns on whether there's a court decision either dismissing the first, the initial indictment, or a court decision somehow holding without dismissing that the government cannot proceed on the initial indictment. I'm not
really. What would that be your argument if, assume for the sake of discussion, that the government had impaneled and there was evidence of deliberate racial discrimination in the impaneling of the grand jury. All people of African descent were off. It was a lily white grand jury, and it was done deliberately. Would the government's position be that unless a court had rendered a decision, the grand jury was still a validly constituted grand jury, and that its actions were not void ab initio?
Well, the question as to whether that's void or not, we think is a little bit different. The question as to whether it was validly pending, I think we would take the position that it was validly pending until there was a court decision indicating it wasn't. Now, if if
I thought we had decisions from the U.S. Supreme Court that indicated that in an instance like that, there wasn't a grand jury at all to speak of. The actions would be in fact void, and that you didn't need any, you didn't need anybody to say it. It was a function of the structural defect that existed. Am I wrong about that?
Your Honor, I think it's been held to be structural error, and you don't need to show that it was harmful. I think it's a little bit of a different inquiry into whether or not it was validly pending for purposes of the, you know, of Grady and Friedman. And I think, and but certainly, you know, then you also, you know, on the question of the void versus voidable, and that shifting gears a little bit there, then you're starting to have an error that more closely approximates the type of error that the Supreme Court has held is void. This sort of failure to swear the grand jury, you know, a grand jury sitting without authority. You're starting to resemble that. You're starting to see that sort of more systemic issue. So on the void versus voidable, you are starting to look at more of a void issue. I don't believe that the Supreme Court said void. I know they said
structural. Well, I'm a little curious. I'm not sure why you're pushing back on this. You win, don't you, if we adopt what Alexander said?
We do, Your Honor, but I also don't want a decision from this court necessarily saying it turns on void versus voidable. So I agree that in this case that we win. You know, if the court wants to assume that the test were void versus voidable, I do agree that we have shown here that the indictment was not void.
Well, that's the test that Alexander applied, isn't it? Alexander looked at this issue, and the way it framed it, the panel there framed it in terms of this is not so fundamental as to have caused the grand jury to no longer be a grand jury.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, it was the same issue, but as applied to a different, the issue there was whether or not this was a right not to be tried for purposes of interlocutory appeal. So for that inquiry, they had to determine whether or not it was void or not. But we're saying here, it's a question of whether it was validly pending. And we don't think the question of validly pending turns on void or not. We think if it's void or voidable, until there's a decision from the court, it's still validly pending. Now, even if the court holds that a first indictment is validly pending, unless it is void, or if voidable, there's a decision from the court, we still win because this is not a void indictment.
Yeah, maybe my colleagues have a different take on this or want to take this in a different direction, but I'm just pressing you a little bit on it because I'm not sure why it matters to you. I mean, we have a decision of this court, which is quite arguably dispositive on the issue. We said in Alexander, this is not so fundamental a defect as to make the indictment no longer an indictment. It's not that. Well, why aren't you happy just to take that to the bank and say, hey, you don't have to do anything here. This court already decided this. This case is over before it starts. See Alexander. Why aren't you delighted at that? And why are you trying to get us to decide this on a different basis?
Your Honor, I am delighted by that. And I will certainly take that holding from the court. The government is concerned about is that if the government does not push back on that test, we are going to see a decision from this court saying that if a decision were void, it would not be validly pending under Grady. Now, that's not an issue that you need to raise here because it's not an argument that was made by the defendant, but I'm simply making this argument to make it clear that the government doesn't concede that issue, but even under the test advanced by the defendant, we win under the holding in Alexander that this is not the type of decision or that this is not the type of error that would render the indictment void.
So the government's position, and you would prefer a decision that said even an action by the grand jury, which is so defective as to constitute no decision at all, to be void, is still a validly pending indictment, unless and until there's a court decision. That's how you'd like us to decide this.
No, Your Honor. Our preferred decision would be the defendant has raised one argument as to why the initial indictment was not validly pending, and that is that the indictment is void. Assuming that that is the test, and assuming because the defendant has waived any other argument for why the initial indictment was not validly pending, we will apply that test. And applying that test, the indictment here is not void.
Okay.
It wouldn't be, maybe it's the same question Judge Jordan is asking, but if the error were structural, assume hypothetically you had a structural error, would the indictment have been pending despite the structural errors?
Yes, Your Honor, I would believe so. I don't think a structural error makes the indictment void. I'm not aware of any holding to that effect.
Okay, Judge Roth, anything from you?
I have nothing for it.
Judge Mady? Okay, well, thanks for your argument, Mr. Sleeper. Ms. Dowling, we'll hear your rebuttal.
Your Honor, I believe the government is saying that unless a court decides, an indictment is validly pending. And I believe that the defendant, of course, rejects that argument, as well as the defendant rejects the argument that this is not a fundamental defect and it's not structural with regards to what happened in the grand jury. The Fifth Amendment guarantees a defendant the right to be charged by a grand jury. That grand jury must also be impartial, unbiased. If the grand jury is going to sit and include a victim on the grand jury with regards to a victim of the crimes that are being presented to the grand jury, then that is structurally and fundamentally unfair. It violates the defendant's constitutional rights to be charged by a grand jury, and that goes to the integrity of the grand jury process. It's not, we cannot have a ruling that this was an unbiased grand jury. And remember,
well,
now,
everybody, I think, is in agreement that the original grand jury was tainted and that there is a defect in that original indictment. So the problem we're wrestling with, Ms. Dowling, is not the one you're pointing at, because you're 100% right about that, that there's a taint there, and that it, and that what happened couldn't be tolerated as a matter of procedure to go forward. But that isn't where the story ends. There was a superseding indictment with a grand jury that everybody concedes didn't have that taint. And so the challenge we're faced with, and that you need to answer, is why isn't that good enough? Why isn't it good enough that Ms. Gussie was in fact indicted by a grand jury that did not labor under that taint?
Your Honor, that is not good enough because remember that Ms. Gussie could not even challenge that or bring up the defect to the indictment process. Because first of all, she's not privy to that process. And secondly, the government sat on the information and never told it. The government's indictment that came, the superseding indictment, came well beyond the statute of limitations period. And more than the delay from the time the government knew to the time the government superseded the indictment is an inexcusable delay.
Okay, well, there's at least two arguments in there. One of them is that you're past the statute of limitations, but that assumes the answer we're trying to get at, which is whether that original indictment was so bad and so defective that it was no indictment at all. Because if the answer to that question is no, there was a validly pending indictment and it relates back. So there's not a statute of limitations problem, right? But then, yes, but then you've mixed in there the prosecutorial misconduct piece.
No, Your Honor, I'm saying right off the bat that not having an impartial grand jury is a structural defect. It's not just a mere taint. The right to grand jury to be presented, your crimes presented, is a constitutional right guaranteed by the Fifth Amendment.
Sure, why is it a structural error? I understand your point, but why does the fact that there was a victim on the grand jury make it a structural error as the court has defined that term?
It's a structural error because there is no integrity in the process if a victim of a crime is going to be voting on whether or not to indict the defendant for the same particular crime. There's no integrity in the process. There's no unbiased, the appellant's right to be presented by an unbiased grand jury is deprived when there's a victim of the same crime being voted upon. And that is structural. That goes to the integrity of the grand jury process, to the fundamental right that you have to a grand jury. That challenges that, and that basically it obliterates the process. The process is no process when you're gonna have the victim voting to decide whether or not you should be indicted. Okay. There's no process. It just totally destroys the process. There's no integrity in the process.
All right. I think we understand your argument. Let me ask Judge Roth if she has anything further.
I have nothing further.
Judge Mady. Okay. Then we thank you, Ms. Dowling, for your argument on behalf of Ms. Gussie. We thank you, Mr. Sleeper, for your argument on behalf of the government. We've got the matter under advisement, and we'll get a decision to you.